Ave podcast listeners, a quick notice. To celebrate the 10th year of the Emperors of Rome podcast, we will be holding a live podcast and special screening of the hit movie Gladiator. It's on Saturday, 19th of October at 4:30 p.m. at the Thornbury Picture House in Melbourne, and tickets are now on sale on their website. There's a link in the show notes. We hope to see you there. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Rhiannon Evans, an associate professor in classics and ancient history at La Trobe University. This is episode CCXXIX, Clodius Pulcher and the Bona Dea. The Bona Dea was a goddess of Rome whose celebrations were the secret domain of elite women. To our male Roman sources, they were mysterious and magical. That is until Clodius Pulcher decided he would gatecrash. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Bona Dea, or the Good Goddess, was a Roman goddess worshipped in a festival in early December. It was secret, it was exclusive, it was celebrated by women only, and it was quite elite, so a very elite woman in charge of it, the wife of the Pontifex Maximus.
And this isn't a Roman goddess that I've come across very often.
Really, Matt? You're not over no. All of the Roman gods, every single one of them?
Maybe because I'm not involved in the secret club for this for this goddess in particular.
Yeah, she's pretty obscure, it should be said. We just don't have much remaining that tells us much about her. We don't have the temples. There aren't that many mythic narratives like we get with lots of the gods, origin stories or whatever. When we do hear about her in written texts, it often seems to be a case of she needs to be explained to people. So possibly she was a bit obscure even in antiquity. Both Greek and Roman texts are, you know, well, this is what the Bona Dea is. And they're contradictory explanations as well, certainly about her origins.
I can kind of buy that because our sources are written by men. So does the confusion around it echo their confusion around Bona Dea and the mystery surrounding it and the fact that men aren't involved in the worship of her?
So there is a bit of that, I'm sure. But still, if she turns up in myth and literature, which she largely doesn't, then we would kind of have more of those stories about it. We could compare maybe, this is not a direct comparison, because there is already a Roman version of this, but say with the Greek Demeter. All right, so her festival is for women only. For initiates. It's a mystery cult. We don't know what went on, but there are mythic narratives about her, about her daughter being snatched into the underworld.
Okay.
So I think what makes Bona Dea especially mysterious is that we don't really have many of those stories. Also, the fact that she's called the Good Goddess suggests that this is a pseudonym for her real name. We're not allowed to know her real name.
Oh, okay.
That's what it suggests, because it's descriptive rather than a name.
There weren't temples to her. There weren't priests or priestesses per se.
No, which is why you have the Pontifex Maximus's wife presiding over the big important festival of Bona Dea.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so what do we know about her?
So she comes up in the kind of texts where Roman culture is being explained. So no surprise, Plutarch. In his life of Julius Caesar, and it will become clear why this gets talked about in the life of Caesar as we talk. And he says, to quote, this is from chapter 9, "The Romans have a goddess whom they call Bona, corresponding to the Greek gynaikia, which means womany things. The Phrygians claim the goddess as their own." So already we've got some conflict here, not actually Roman, but coming from Phrygian, it's Trojan really, from the east.
Right.
"And say she was the mother of King Midas." I have to say, there are a lot of conflicting myths about Midas, so that's no surprise. "The Romans say she was a dryad nymph and the wife of Faunus," which suggests that she's associated with trees and the wild countryside. So Faunus is a kind of goat-footed god, a bit like Pan.
Mr. Tumnus.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Floats around in the woods, and dryad is a tree nymph. "The Greeks say that she was the unnameable one among the mothers of Dionysus." Whatever that means. I mean, Dionysus has a mother in Greek myth called Semele. The unnameable one, again, adds to that mystery, that idea that we can't know her true name.
That tells me that Plutarch's confused.
Yeah.
And he's hedging his bets.
Well, Plutarch has clearly heard several different... He's done his research, come on. And he knows that there are several different versions. I have to say that I think it's important that we do take the Romans at their word. At least this is what they believed. So I guess it's the important thing for
That's
us
what's
here.
That's important, yes.
That she is very much this woodlandy nymph, which straight away is a bit typical Roman paradox, because the woodland is associated with kind of simplicity and, you know, living in this very frugal way. And yet the festival is celebrated by one of the most elite women in Rome.
Mm.
Anyway.
Slightly contradicting.
Go figure with the Romans.
Yeah.
Then we get from a much later source, Macrobius, in his Saturnalia, which contains just anecdotes from everywhere. I mean, it's 12 books from memory, a lot of books of people telling each other stories, and often it's about the origins of things.
Mm-hmm.
He says, this is in book one, chapter 12, the pontiff's books invoke the same goddess as the good goddess Fauna, Ops, and Fatua. So she's got different names. So he does name some of the names. Fauna is just it's a feminine form of Faunus. Ops means plenty or wealth. And Fatua, well, there are different versions of what that means, and that'll come up here in Macrobius' explanation. She's good because she causes all things that are good for us in living our lives. That's pretty imprecise. Fauna, because she nurtures. This is from the Latin verb fauere, that is useful to living creatures. Ops, because life depends on her assistance. And Fatua, from speaking, the verb fari, because, as I said above, newborn babies do not make a sound before they have touched the earth. It's pretty Whoa. Involved, isn't it? So, again,
that's somebody
lots.
Who hasn't been at a birth.
Yeah, well, that too, yes. Also, I thought that Fatua was going to be to do with rumor and fate. This seems really tangential to say that it's to do with newborn babies.
Yeah.
Quite where that comes from, Macrobius just seems to have taken things from all over the place here. And again, it may be that there are various sources that say these things. There probably are. But the fact that he puts them all together is a bit weird. And he's got another version too. Some say that this goddess has Juno's power, and for that she was given a scepter to hold in her left hand.
Right.
So Juno's the goddess of marriage, family, motherhood. This may be why she's associated with Bonadea, who's a particularly a female goddess, and apparently has some association with birth.
Mm.
Very obscure, quite what Macrobius is getting at there. Doesn't necessarily tie up with everything else. Also, we should say that once she's been associated with Faunus and that whole Fauere to nurture, that's probably where the whole motherly, cuddly element comes from.
Yes.
But that's some dodgy etymology. The Romans and the Greeks love their dodgy etymologies.
Mm.
So we've got a lot of this, you know, oh, that word sounds a bit like this. Therefore, it must be this narrative going on.
Okay. So I'm getting the impression that it's life, it's birth, and et cetera. It's women domain.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, we can tell that from the ceremony.
Yes.
And that I think it's not too far to assume that the celebration was meant to ensure good fortune and, I don't know, maybe safety in birth, giving birth for women.
It strikes me as Magna Mater.
Yes. But Magna Mater has been brought in from outside.
Yeah. Sorry, context. That was like the mother of Rome because we captured a rock.
Yes. Yeah. So, and similarly, you know, Magna Mater, well, she does have a name, Cybele, but being called Magna Mater is kind of a role, isn't it?
Yeah.
A descriptive role. And maybe Bonadea is a kind of, not equivalent exactly, but one who potentially is indigenous to the Italians and to the Romans. She's certainly got a Latin name.
So despite all that obscurity around her name and her role, you said scepter. Does that come across in portrayals of her? Do we have statues and those sort of things?
We do have rare statues, not loads of them, but they tend to show her carrying out a kind of a ritual. She's got a libation bowl. So you'd put, you know, whatever, milk, wine, and pour that as part of a religious ceremony. And sometimes a serpent in her right hand. And in the other hand, not a scepter, but a cornucopia, which is a horn of plenty, which, you know, associates her potentially with Ops. Macrobius is interpreting that as help and assistance, but it does also have this idea of wealth and fertility. This is really, I think, a connection to the earth itself and with abundance, with the fertility of the earth and, I guess, of humans, rather than the scepter would suggest dominion over the earth and over people. It's like she's in charge, which you could argue Juno is.
Yeah.
Jupiter definitely is. But she seems to be a helper more than somebody who orders you around. We do also have an inscription. It's actually from a man, and it shows gratitude to Bonadea. This is from Pompeii. That's what CIL6 means. All right, I'll read it.
Does it?
The corpus of Latin inscriptions, if it's got a 1 at the start, it's Rome.
Yeah.
And then 2, 3, 4, 5 are different places, and 6 is Pompeii. So the Pompeii one is often divided into lots of mini ones because there are so many.
There you go. Did not know that.
Okay. The enslaved man says, Felix Asinianus, public slave of the priests, so already associated with a religious group, fulfilled his vow to Bonadea Agrestis Felicula, willingly and with good cause, sacrificing a white heifer on account of his eyesight having been restored. Abandoned by doctors, he recovered after 10 months by taking medicines by the aid of the mistress. Here she's been called the mistress, and she is, again, associated with helping somebody medically. Not a woman, not even a citizen. But it's notable that she's called Bonadea Agrestis, which is kind of wild countrysidey, and Felicula, which is kind of blessed, happy. I think that ties up with some of what we've seen in the written text, in the literary texts too.
Okay. So since the main thing that we know about Bonadea seems to be the rituals, the ceremonies that are associated with her, because it seems like it was also an excuse for a bit of a party.
Well, remember we've only got male written texts.
Yeah, okay, all right. Yeah,
they don't know what was going on because they weren't there.
I'm not reducing this to a book club that doesn't read books, but it is the women of the household getting together without the men.
Not only not allowed in the ceremony, but they have to leave the premises. And that includes enslaved men.
Yeah.
And it includes male pets.
That is very thorough.
And it's not just any home. I've said it's usually the wife of the Pontifex Maximus. So it's got to be a Roman magistrate.
Yeah.
And the famous case we know of, it's at the home of the Pontifex Maximus. So this is a grand home. And it means the chief priest has to leave home. He's chucked out for the night.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. Okay, so what do we know about this ritual then?
Ugh, they're so confused, these writers, about what's going on. No surprise.
These male writers.
Yeah, exactly. Got a bit from Cicero, where he's talking about religion in a text where he's discussing prophecies. He says, "What is so secret as that which fences itself against the eyes, not only of the inquisitive, but even of the idle, and to which access is debarred, not merely from wickedness, but even from inadvertency?" So you can't pretend that you were just wandering by the chief priest's house and you happened to look in the window. It's not good enough. That won't pass muster. You will be punished if that happens. Cicero does tell us a little bit about the ritual here. He tells us there's a sacrifice. No surprise, I guess. The festival is always held in the house of a magistrate with imperium. That's a pretty rare power, really high power that only top magistrates have, consuls, praetors, chief priests. And that men aren't even allowed to know the name of the goddess. He's backing up again this secrecy, this anonymous nature of who she is. I guess it's important that it remains secret for it to be efficacious. Plutarch does tell it as a party. He says, again, in the life of Caesar, the most important rites are celebrated by night. I mean, that is always suspicious to male writers. What are these women up to at night? And they've kicked all the men out. He says, mirth attends the revels and music too. So it does sound like a party to him. I mean, who knows what kind of music it is. But he implies that they're having a good old time there. Back to Macrobius, that later writer, tells us the victim at the festival of Bonadea is a pig. Now, this is a bit weird because Roman women, priestesses, didn't usually carry out blood sacrifice. If they carried out any kind of ritual like that, they'd be offering up wine or corn or milk, you know, something that doesn't involve slaughter. So this puts Bonadea in a bit of a different category. And we've also got in Juvenal. Let me preface this by saying Juvenal wrote satire. It's a genre of poetry not known for its veracity, at the very least exaggerating.
This is him just imagining what's going on behind that closed door.
And this is from Juvenal Satire 6, which is the very long poem that inveighs against getting married because women are terrible.
Right.
Right?
Okay.
So, yeah, by and large.
So they clearly can't be trusted, and this is an example of why.
Yeah, they're all committing adultery, they're plotting to kill you.
They're not even reading the books that have been set there for the week.
And this is funny, the way it starts. This is about 300 lines in, so it's not the start of the poem, but the way he starts talking about this ritual. Everyone knows the secret rites of the good goddess, which surely, when he wrote that, he must have known nobody of his sex knows. When the flute excites the loins, so he's already saying it's sexual, and crazed by music and wine alike, the maenads of Priapus are carried away, whirling their hair and howling. So again, very sexual. So Maenads, followers of Dionysus, they're out of control, they're drunk. Priapus is the god of, he's the hyperphallic god who protects gardens, you know.
I know that god.
Attacks people.
Yeah.
You know that one. Okay.
He's all over the walls of Pompeii.
Yes. Yeah. As a kind of apotropaic device. It carries on, though. Juvenal says, how their minds are all on fire to get laid then. How they squeal to the dance of their desire. There's a shout in unison from the entire grotto. Now is the time. Send in the men. If her lover's asleep, she'll tell his son to put on his cloak and hurry along. If that's no good, there's an assault on the slaves.
Wow.
Okay, so he imagines that men are actually being admitted to this, that it's an orgy.
Yeah, but he's got issues as well, this guy.
I think he probably does.
Yeah, just a few.
Yeah. I've kind of got this cloak of religious ritual, which means that they're kind of the men who should be in the household have been excluded, which means that they can admit other men that they want to have affairs with.
Yeah, but it's also, this is a religious ritual, but it's an excuse for tarting it up.
Indeed. And that makes it even worse, all right? If they were just having affairs, that would be bad enough. Mm. But the fact that they pervert this supposedly sacred ceremony, I have no doubt that this is nonsense.
Yeah.
The Romans took these ceremonies pretty seriously.
So this brings us to the main source that we've got for the ceremony of Bona Dea, which, as you've said, is Plutarch in the house of the Pontifex Maximus, who is, drum roll,
Julius Caesar.
Julius Caesar.
So at least in 62 BCE.
Yes, for this particular ritual. And that's because Julius Caesar's wife is involved as the person presiding over the ceremony. And there is invariably a scandal, which is why Plutarch is interested, I gather.
Yes. Yeah. So at this point, Caesar is, he's not as powerful as he'll become, but he's a praetor, so he's got imperium, which means that his wife, his second wife, Pompeia, can hold this festival in her house. The scandal that occurs at this celebration is that a man turns up in disguise. And this man is not just any man, but he is prime enemy later on of Cicero. He's a man called Clodius Pulcher. So he's kind of got a party boy reputation as it is. Plus, the Pulcher part of his name means handsome, beautiful. He's a pretty boy. Plutarch describes him as a man of patrician birth, so very high birth, just like Julius Caesar, in fact, and conspicuous for wealth and eloquence. But in insolence and effrontery, he surpassed all the notorious scoundrels of his time. Now, Plutarch says that the reason that Clodius sneaks into this ceremony is not just because he's curious. Maybe he wants to write the text that exposes what actually happens at this ceremony. He says that Clodius was in love with Pompeia, with Julius Caesar's wife. And according to Plutarch, now this is going to be debated elsewhere, she was more than willing. So she wanted this to happen. She was an active participant here. But she couldn't actually have the affair in normal outside Bona Dea ritual times because Caesar's mother, who's called Aurelia, was keeping a close watch on her. Mm-hmm. So she couldn't get away and have this clandestine affair. And because Clodius is still young, he's beardless, according to Plutarch. We know he was about 30. He could get away with dressing up as a girl, basically. And he dresses up as a lute girl and is smuggled into the house by Pompeia's slave, who is called Abra, and told to wait. All was going to plan until Clodius got bored waiting and started prowling around the house. Plutarch says, a large house, which is no surprise, and desperately trying to avoid being close to any torches because he doesn't want to be seen and exposed.
Okay, so sneaking around a house, and all men have left by this point.
Oh, yes, so very much so.
And the rituals are in full swing.
Things start to go wrong. One of Aurelia, remember Julius Caesar's mother's attendants, just accidentally comes upon him and asks him to play with her as one woman would with another. This is directly from Plutarch.
What does that mean?
Exactly.
Okay.
The verb used is paisdein, which means play or sport. It can mean play a musical instrument.
Okay.
He refuses, and she drags him forward and asks who he is and where he came from. He says that he's waiting for Pompeia's slave, Abra, but his voice betrayed him. So I guess he has a masculine voice and is not very good at disguising it. A bit rubbish, Clodius. Surely you could put some effort in there.
Just talk a bit like this.
No, that sounds like it's from Little Britain.
Go with Monty Python.
Yes.
Hello. I'm going to play my lute now.
This bit I particularly like in the description. I can just imagine Plutarch thinking, what would a young female servant think if she started talking to someone and it was clear from their voice they were a man? She'd be so shocked.
Mm.
So the attendant of Aurelia, according to Plutarch, at once sprang away with a scream, crying out that she had caught a man.
Mm.
Then Plutarch says the women were panic-stricken. Aurelia put a stop to the mystic rites of the goddess and covered up the emblems. Don't know, statues of the goddess, possibly, some important part of the ritual. Then she ordered the doors to be closed and went about the house with torches, searching for Clodius. He was found where he had taken refuge in the chamber of the girl who had let him into the house. When they saw who he was, the women drove him out of doors. Okay, so that's from Plutarch, Life of Caesar, chapter 10.
It's interesting that Pompeia isn't mentioned beyond Clodius wants to get off with her. You know, she's not the one going around the house searching for an intruder or anything like that, even though she's the one presiding over it. It's Julius Caesar's mother and it's her servant who are the active ones in the household. So that's interesting in itself.
Well, I guess this plays along with Plutarch's rendering of it, which is that Pompeia wanted to have this affair.
Yeah.
So Aurelia, who's the one with morals, kind of takes over at that point. And I guess as the mother of the chief priest and the magistrate with Imperium, she also has a lot of authority, even though it's not her house. Other accounts don't make Pompeia an active participant in this. In Dio Cassius, she's kind of apparently innocent.
Mm.
So I think Plutarch has decided to go with this line. He may well have sources that say this.
I really don't know what he was trying to achieve by doing this.
Clodius.
Yeah.
Well, there are various theories, one of which is that he was just very curious, that it wasn't necessarily about an affair.
Mm.
And also that being this, as we called him, larrikin, it was like, you know, this is a secret thing only women can go to, like almost daring yourself, being bold, being audacious.
Yeah.
Let's see if I can get away with this and find out what goes on with these women. What are they up to?
Yeah, but in that case, you jump into the room with the main ritual and go, ha-ha! And, you know, you don't just skulk around trying to avoid torches and get caught in a corridor.
Well, then you'd never get to the main ritual.
Because you can't even play a bloody lute.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's all very mysterious and womanly to me.
Well, that's the way it's meant to be, Matt. You're not meant to know what goes on in this household. I have to say, at the end of reading these accounts by men, I feel like I am none the wiser, really.
So what's the reaction to all of this? Is Clodius Pulcher punished for barging in on this sacred ceremony?
He is, yes. He's put on trial, and the charge is something called incestum, which is not incest, although it's spelt the same.
Mm.
It means sacrilege. But it's got that chastity word bound up in it,
Castus.
There is that kind of implication of it that he's perverted the ceremony in some way.
Right.
And because the festival is held on behalf of the people of Rome, it's prosecuted by a tribune of the plebs. All right. So it's not prosecuted by Julius Caesar or someone in his family. It's actually like he's offended the Roman state. Now, it's a strange kind of trial by our standards because the witnesses who are there, the women, can't give testimony in a Roman law court. The men could give evidence of Clodius's character. Cicero does this. Caesar does not give any testimony, which suggests even at this earlier stage, that Caesar was trying to save Clodius. Because this guy's turned up in his own house. If he comes and speaks about him, it'll be weird if he doesn't say something negative. So he just remains silent and refuses to give testimony.
Yeah, but I mean, there's something to be said about not making a scandal worse than it already is. For this to happen in his household, at the very least, infers lax security or something like that, you know?
It does. It's a bit rubbish, isn't it? I get the feeling that certainly in the accounts we have, there's this idea that no one would ever have thought this would happen.
Yeah.
Some of the norms that are being broken, say, politically in certain places in the world today.
Yeah.
We sort of don't have rules against it because you just wouldn't have thought you'd need them.
So I imagine that there are rules after this as a result.
We don't know of them, but there may have been.
Okay. Well,
certainly the person who holds it the next year, you'd think, would be a bit more careful.
Maybe stand a couple of guys at the door. They can't come in, but just make sure that no one else does.
Pompey is really the one who suffers. Caesar divorces her instantly. Is it infidelity? Has she been a willing participant? It's a public scandal and he's making his career. He's on the rise.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing to him. And he was asked why he divorced her. Plutarch tells us this. His statement, basically a statement of support of Clodius by not giving testimony, appears strange. And the prosecutor therefore asked, why then did you divorce your wife? Because, said Caesar, I thought my wife ought not to be even under suspicion.
Yeah.
He's within his rights to accuse Clodius, but he doesn't do it. The suggestion is he doesn't really think anything bad's going on, but he can't afford the scandal.
Mm.
Clodius doesn't really suffer. He's acquitted on a narrow margin. And it's Cicero, who, of course, is just his implacable enemy, thinks that there's bribery going on with the jury, which is quite possible.
Yeah.
And it's quite possible that Caesar was part of that bribery. Clodius has got off, so there is no scandal. His wife's no longer there, so even if you suspected that he should have been found guilty, well, Pompey is not around anymore. So this is where the phrase of Caesar's wife must be above suspicion comes from. That any kind of whiff of scandal and you just cut off the offending part of your family, even though
harsh.
You're sacrificing someone else for something they might not have done.
That was Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe, leave a review, and tell your friends about it. You can find us on any readily available podcatching platform. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook. You can also follow us on the desecrated remains of Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.